The imposing silence of the night. The terror that froze my senses. That image of nature at peace contrasting with the upheaval of my distraught mind. All of these things filled me with the darkest horror, which soon made me want to pray. I threw myself at the knees of that God Almighty denied by the impious, hope of the poor and the afflicted.
"Holy and majestic being," I cried in tears, "you who at this frightful moment deign to fill my soul with celestial joy, and who have doubtless prevented me from trying to take my life. Oh, my protector and my guide, I ask for your benevolence, I implore your clemency. Look kindly upon my misery and my torments, my humility and my prayers. Almighty God, you know that I am weak and innocent, mistreated and betrayed. I wanted to follow your example by doing good, and it is your will that I be punished for it. Then, let your will be done, my Lord. All its sacred consequences are dear to me. I respect them, and shall never complain of them again. But, if I am to encounter nothing but thorns here on earth, would it offend you, my sovereign master, if I asked you to use your powers to call me back to you so that I may worship you undisturbed, that I may adore you far from these perverted men who, alas, have brought nothing but evil upon my head and whose bloody and perfidious hands take pleasure in drowning my sad days in torrents of tears and an abyss of suffering?
Prayer is the sweetest consolation of the unfortunate, who derive strength from fulfillment of this duty. I got to my feet, my courage renewed, picked up the rags the scoundrel had left me, and hid myself in a copse where I could spend the night with less risk. The safety I now considered I enjoyed, the satisfaction I had just derived from communion with my God, all helped me to get a few hours' rest, and the sun was already high in the sky when my eyes opened again. The moment of reawakening is a terrible one for the unfortunate. Refreshed in the gentle arms of Morpheus, the imagination is more quickly and more gloomily filled with terrors which those deceptive hours of rest had erased from the memory. "Oh, well," I said to myself as I examined my bruises. "So it is true that there are human creatures that nature reduces to the level of wild beasts. What difference is there now between them and me? Hiding away in my hole, avoiding men who behave like them? Is it even worth being born to endure such a pitiful fate?" And my tears flowed in abundance as I made these sad reflections. I had only just had these thoughts when I heard noises nearby. Gradually, I could make out the voices of two men, and so I pricked up my ears. "Come along, my dear friend," said one of them. "This place is perfect for us. Here the cruel and fateful presence of an aunt whom I detest will not prevent me from tasting with you for a moment those pleasures that I find so sweet." They approached each other, placing themselves just in front of me so that nothing they said or did could escape my attention, and I saw. Dear heaven, madame, why is it that fate only ever put me in such awkward situations that it becomes as difficult for virtue to hear their account as for modesty to describe them? That horrible crime which outrages both nature and social convention, that sin which the hand of God has so often punished, a crime legitimated by Ironheart, suggested by him to the unfortunate Thérèse and consummated with her against her will by the inhuman wretch who has just sacrificed her, that revolting execration was performed before my eyes, with all of the impurest inventions and most awful episodes that the most ingenious depravity can imagine. One of these men, the one who indulged in it, was 24 years old, well enough attired to make one think that he was of high social rank. The other man, of about the same age, appeared to be one of his servants. The act was scandalous and lengthy. Supporting himself with his hands on the crest of a small hillock opposite the thicket in which I was hidden, the young master laid bare the impious altar of sacrifice to the companion of his debauchery, while the latter, filled with ardour at the sight, caressed his idol as he got ready to sacrifice it with a blade much bigger and far more frightful than the one with which the leader of the gang of brigands of Bondi had threatened me. Yet, in no way apprehensive, the young master seemed to confront the weapon presented to him with impunity. He teased it, tickled it, covered it with kisses, grabbed hold of it and penetrated himself with it, in ecstasy as he swallowed it. Inflamed by his criminal caresses, the vile man thrashed around with the blade inside him and seemed to regret that it was not even more daunting. He braved the thrusts, anticipating and responding to them. Two tender and legitimate spouses could not have caressed each other with greater ardour. Their mouths pressed together, their sighs mingled, their tongues intertwined, and I could see that both were drunk with lust, finding the complement of their perfidious atrocities in this orgy of passion. The ceremony was repeated, and the passive partner spared no effort in bringing the incense back to life, employing every means to renew declining strength. Kissing, fondling, defilements, debauched actions of the greatest refinement imaginable. And all of these succeeded in rekindling their desires 5 times in a row, but without either of them changing roles. The young master was always the woman, and although he was able to play the man in his turn, he did not appear to want to do this for one moment. If he visited the altar similar to his own at which the sacrifice was made, it was for the pleasure of the other idol, which never seemed to be threatened by any attack. Oh, how time seemed to drag. I dared not move for fear of being noticed. Finally, the criminal actors of this indecent scene, their lusts doubtless satisfied, got up to resume their journey along the path that I supposed must take them home, when the master approached the bush where I was hidden. My bonnet betrayed me. He caught sight of it.
"Jasmine," he said to his valet, "we've been discovered. A girl has seen our mysteries. Come, let's flush the whore out and find out what she's doing here."
I saved them the trouble of pulling me out of my hiding place, immediately dragging myself out and falling at their feet.
"Oh, monsieur,"
I cried, holding my arms out to them.
"Please have pity on an unfortunate woman whose lot is more to be deplored than you may think. There are very few reversals of fortune that can equal my own. The situation in which you have found me should not raise any suspicions about me. It is not so much my fault as the result of my misfortune. But rather than adding to the ills that have befallen me, I beg you to lessen them by providing me with the means to escape the bad luck that dogs me."
The Comte de Bressac, for such was the young man's name, into whose hands I had fallen, was not favoured with an abundance of sympathy in his heart, but rather possessed a considerable degree of wickedness and libertinism in his head. It is unfortunately all too common to see how libertinism can extinguish pity in man. Its usual effect is to harden the heart, either because most of its crimes require an apathy of the soul, or because the violent effects that this passion has on the entire nervous system reduces the strength of its functioning. However this may be, a libertine is rarely a sensitive man. Moreover, this natural harshness in the type of individuals whose character I am describing was joined in Monsieur Bressac by such an inveterate disgust for our sex, and such a strong hatred for everything that characterizes it, that it was very difficult for me to find in his heart those feelings that I wished to arouse in him.
"My little dove," the Comte said to me harshly, "if you are looking for people to make fools of, you'd better look elsewhere. Neither my friend nor I ever worship at the impure temple of your sex. If it's charity you're asking for, go and look for people who like doing good works. We never do anything of the sort. But speak, wretch. Did you see what passed between this gentleman and myself?"
"I saw you both chatting on the grass," I replied. "Nothing else, monsieur, I assure you."
"I want to believe you," said the young Comte, "for your own good. If I thought that you could have seen anything else, you would never leave this forest. Jasmine, it's still early. We have the time to hear this girl's adventures, and afterwards we'll see what must be done with her."
These young men sat down and ordered me to sit beside them. Then I skillfully recounted all of the misfortunes that had assailed me since I came into the world.
Come, Jasmine,
said Monsieur de Bressac, getting to his feet as soon as I had finished.
Let us be fair for once. Just Temis has condemned this creature. Let us not allow the goddess's intentions to be cruelly frustrated. Let us carry out the death sentence that this young criminal has incurred. Far from being a crime, this little murder will merely constitute reparation of the moral order. Since we are unfortunate enough to disturb it sometimes, let us have the courage to restore it, at least when the occasion presents itself.
And having lifted me from where I sat, the cruel men were already dragging me into the woods, laughing at my tears and my cries.
Let's bind her by all four of her limbs to four trees to form a rectangle,
said Bressac, stripping me naked. Then, using their scarves, handkerchiefs, and garters, they made ropes with which I was instantly bound as they had planned, that is to say, in the most cruel and most painful manner that is possible to imagine. One cannot express how much I suffered. It seemed to me that my limbs were being torn off, and that my stomach, facing downward and dragged by its own weight to the ground, must be ripped open at any moment. Sweat ran down my brow. I existed only in the violence of pain. If it had ceased to compress my nerves, I should have been seized by mortal anguish. The villains enjoyed watching me in this position, applauding their efforts.
"That's enough now," said Bressac finally. "I think she's been frightened enough for the time being. Thérèse," he continued, releasing my bonds and ordering me to get dressed, "follow us and hold your tongue. If you do what I say, you won't have cause to regret it. My aunt requires another companion. Trusting that what you have told me is true, I'm going to introduce you to her. I shall vouch to her for your conduct, but if you abuse my favors, if you betray my trust or do not submit to my will... See these four trees, Thérèse, and the area they enclose, a place that was to be your grave. And remember that this gloomy spot is only 1 league from the castle to which I am taking you, and that the slightest act of disobedience will see you brought back here straight away.
I immediately forgot my misfortunes, threw myself at the Comte's feet, and in tears I gave him my word that I would do what he asked. However, he was as insensitive to my joy as to my pain.
On your feet, said Bressac. Your behaviour will speak for you. It alone will determine your fate.
We walked on, Jasmine and his master talking softly together, with me following humbly without saying a word. In less than an hour, we reached the castle of Madame la Marquise de Bressac, whose magnificence and large number of servants made me realise that whatever position I was to be given in this household, it would surely be of greater benefit to me than that of chief housekeeper at Monsieur du Harpin's. I was made to wait in a servant's hall, where Jasmine obligingly offered me everything he could to make me feel at home. The young comte went to see his aunt and tell her about me. Half an hour later, he came to fetch me himself to introduce me to the marquise. Madame de Bressac was a woman aged 46, still very beautiful, who seemed to me to be honest and sensitive, although there was a little severity in her principles and manner of speaking. She had been widowed 2 years earlier by the young comte's uncle, who had given her nothing when he married her but his fine name. All the wealth and property that Monsieur de Bressac might hope to acquire would be inherited from his aunt, what he had got from his father affording him scarcely enough to provide for his pleasures. To this Madame de Bressac added a considerable pension, but it was not enough. There was nothing so expensive as the comte's pleasures. These may not have cost as much as others, but they were far more frequent. The household required 50,000 écus income, and Monsieur de Bressac was all alone. It had never been possible to persuade him to take up an occupation. Anything that got in the way of his libertine activities was so unbearable to him that he could not assume the responsibility. The marquise lived on the property for 3 months a year, spending the rest of the time in Paris, and these 3 months, which she required her nephew to spend with her, were like torture for a man who abhorred his aunt. He felt that he was wasting all the time he spent away from a town which, for him, was the centre of his pleasures. The young comte ordered me to recount to the marquise all of the things I had told him, and as soon as I had finished,
Madame de Pressac said to me, "Your candour and your naivety leave me in no doubt that you are telling the truth. The only other information I shall try to discover about you is whether you are really the daughter of the man you claim to be. If you are, I knew your father, and this will be one more reason for me to take an interest in you. As for the business at Douarpin's, I can sort that out in a couple of visits to the Chancellor, who has been my friend for many years. He is the most honest man in the world, and all we need do is prove your innocence to him, and all accusations made against you will be erased forever. But remember, Thérèse, that I am promising to do this only on condition that you conduct yourself impeccably. So you see that the gratitude I expect from you will always benefit you."
I threw myself at the Marquise's feet, assuring her that she would not be displeased with me. She gently pulled me up and immediately gave me the position in her service of second chambermaid. 3 days later, the inquiries Madame de Bressac had made in Paris were answered, and they were just as I hoped they would be. The Marquise praised me for not deceiving her, and all thoughts of misfortune finally vanished from my mind, to be henceforth replaced by nothing but expectations of the sweetest consolations I might be permitted to entertain. However, it was not decreed in heaven that poor Thérèse should ever be happy, and if fortuitously she was able to enjoy a few moments of tranquillity, it was only to make those horrific times that were to follow all the more bitter. We had scarcely arrived in Paris when Madame de Bressac set about working in my favour. The presiding judge agreed to see me and listened to the account of my misfortunes with interest. Duarpin's calumnies were recognised as such, but any attempts to punish them would be vain. Duarpin had, with impunity, circulated counterfeit banknotes, and in the process ruined several families while making nearly 2 million for himself, and he had fled to England. As far as the fire at the palace prisons was concerned, they were convinced that if I had profited from the event, at least I had had no hand in it, and I was assured that the case against me had been dropped without the magistrates who were handling it having to take any other measures. I was given no more information about this, and accepted what I was told. You will soon see whether or not I was right to do so. It is easy to understand how such actions formed an attachment between Madame de Pressac and myself. Indeed, she showed me all manner of kindnesses. How could such acts not have bound me forever to such a precious protectress? Yet, it was far from the young comte's intentions for me to form such an intimate attachment to his aunt. But now is the time to paint this monster's portrait for you. Monsieur de Bressac combined the most seductive countenance with the charms of youth. If his figure or his features had a few faults, it was because they put me too much in mind of that softness, that nonchalance that belongs only to women. It seemed that, in lending him the attributes of this sex, nature had also endowed him with the same tastes. And yet, what an evil spirit lay concealed beneath these feminine charms. All the vices that characterized the souls of criminals could be found there. Wickedness, debauchery, contempt for all duties, and principally for those with which nature appears to delight us, found in him their strongest expression. Greatest among all his faults, however, was that of hatred for his aunt. The Marquise did everything possible to bring her nephew back to the path of virtue. Perhaps she went about this with too much rigour, and the result was that, even more inflamed by the effects of this severity, the comte indulged his tastes with all the greater impetuosity, and the poor Marquise's only reward for her efforts was to be hated all the more.
"Don't imagine," the comte often said to me, "that everything my aunt does for you comes from her alone, Thérèse. You should know that if I did not keep after her all the time, she would scarcely remember that she promised to help you. She claims to be doing everything herself, whereas it is all my own work." "Yes, Thérèse, oh yes. It is to me alone that you should be grateful. And you should be aware that the gratitude I expect of you is all the more disinterested in that, however pretty you may be. I have no desire to enjoy your favours. No, Thérèse, the services I expect of you are of quite a different kind. And when you are quite convinced of all I have done for you,
I hope that I shall find in your heart what I have a right to expect."
These words seemed so obscure to me that I had no idea how to respond, and yet I did so just in case, and maybe too readily. Should I be honest with you? Alas, yes, because to hide my faults from you would be to betray your trust and ill repay the interest that my misfortunes have inspired in you. You should know, then, madame, that the only voluntary fault with which I must reproach myself... A fault, did I say? A folly, an extravagance. There was never anything like it. But at least it is not a crime, only an error for which I alone was punished, and which the just hand of God did not appear to need in order to plunge me into the abyss which was soon to open up beneath my feet. However unworthily the Comte de Bressac had behaved towards me the first day we had met, it had nevertheless been impossible for me to set eyes on him without feeling myself drawn towards him by a movement of tenderness that nothing could quell. In spite of all my reflections on his cruelty, his distant attitude to women, the depravity of his tastes, and the moral gulf that separated us, nothing in the world could extinguish such a gripping passion, and if the Comte had asked me to lay down my life, I would have sacrificed it for him 1,000 times. He was a long way from suspecting my feelings. The ungrateful man was far from understanding the reason for the tears I shed daily. However, it was impossible for him not to suspect my desire to anticipate everything that might please him. He could not have been unaware of my attentions. Blind as they doubtless were, they went so far as to encourage his faults, as much as decency would allow, and to keep them hidden from his aunt. This behaviour had in some way won his trust, and because everything associated with him was so precious to me, and I was so blind to his coldness towards me, I was sometimes weak enough to believe that he was not indifferent towards me. Yet how the excess of his licentiousness quickly disabused me. This was so great that even his health suffered as a result. I occasionally took the liberty of pointing out to him the disadvantages of his conduct. He would listen to me without repugnance, and after I had finished would say to me that there was no cure for the type of vice that he loved.
"Ah, Thérèse," he cried one day enthusiastically. "If only you knew the charms of this fancy, if you could understand how sweet is the illusion of being a woman. It's an unbelievable mental aberration. You abhor this sex and yet wish to imitate it. Oh, how sweet it is when you succeed, Thérèse. How delicious it is to be the whore of anyone who wants you, and taking delirium and prostitution to its greatest degree, to be in succession on the same day the mistress of a picklock, a marquis, a valet, a monk, to be in turn cherished, caressed, envied, threatened, beaten, at one moment victorious in their arms, and the next victim at their feet, moving them with caresses, reviving their ardour with excesses. Oh, no, no, Thérèse, you cannot understand what such pleasures are like for a temperament such as mine. But quite apart from morality, if only you could imagine what the physical sensations of this divine preference are like. It's impossible to bear it. It's such an intense feeling, and the pleasures awakened are so piquant that you lose your mind, you go crazy. 1,000 kisses, each more tender than the previous one, do not adequately match the intoxication into which we are plunged by our lover. Cradled in his arms, our mouths glued together, we would like our whole existence to be united with his. We would like to become one with him. If we dare to complain, it is of being neglected. We would like him to be stronger than Hercules so that he might enter us and fill us up. We want that precious seed that he shoots like a flame into the depths of our bowels to make our own squirt into his hands because of its heat and force. Do not imagine, Thérèse, that we are made like other men. We are quite differently constructed. When God created us, he arranged for that sensitive membrane that covers the temple of Venus in you women to adorn the altars at which our Celadons worship.
We are just as much women there as you are at the Sanctuary of Reproduction. There is not a single one of your pleasures that is unknown to us, not one that we cannot enjoy, but we also have our own, and it is this delicious combination that makes us the men on Earth most sensitive to pleasure, the best able to feel it. It is this enchanting combination which makes any correction of our inclinations impossible, and which would turn us into enthusiasts and fanatics if one were stupid enough to punish us. In the end, this conjunction ensures that we will continue to adore the charming deity that has us under its spell until we die.
Thus spoke the Comte in praise of his bad habits. Whenever I tried to speak to him of the being to whom he owed everything, and of the concerns that such disorders caused to his respectable aunt, all I got from him was resentment and bad temper, and above all, impatience at seeing riches in such hands and for so long, wealth which, he would say, ought to belong to him. All I could see was the most deeply rooted hatred for this honest woman, and the most demonstrable revolt against all the instincts of nature. Could it then be true that when one has managed to transgress the sacred instincts of this law so absolutely in one's tastes, the necessary consequence of this initial crime should then be a frightful tendency to commit all others? Sometimes I had recourse to the resources of religion. Almost always consoled by these, I tried to fill the soul of this pervert with its solace, in the near certainty that I could restrain him with the bonds of religion if I managed to get him to share its attractions. But the Comte would not allow me to use such weapons for long. Declared enemy of our most holy mysteries, opinionated critic of the purity of our dogmas, savage opponent of the existence of a supreme being, Monsieur de Pressac, instead of allowing me to convert him, sought rather to corrupt me.
"All religions proceed from a false premise, Thérèse," he would say to me. "All assume the worship of a creator to be necessary, but this creator has never existed. In this regard, remember the sensible precepts of that Ironheart who, according to you, Thérèse, had forced you to think just as I am doing. There is nothing more correct than that man's principles, and the low esteem in which you are stupid enough to hold him does not take away his right to argue. If all of nature's products are effects resulting from the laws that govern it, if perpetual actions and reactions presuppose the movement necessary to its essence, what of that sovereign master that fools gratuitously ascribe to it? This is what your wise teacher told you, dear girl. According to this, what are religions if not the break with which the tyranny of the strongest holds the weakest in check? With this aim in mind, the strongest dares to tell him whom he wishes to dominate that a god forged the cruel chains that bind him, and stupefied by his misery, the latter blindly believes everything he is told. Can the religions born of such deceit deserve any respect? Is there a single one, Thérèse, that does not bear the imprint of imposture and stupidity? In all of them, what do I see? Mysteries that make reason tremble, dogmas that outrage nature, and grotesque ceremonies that inspire nothing but derision and disgust. But of all of these, if there is one that especially deserves our hatred and contempt, Thérèse, is it not that barbaric law of Christianity into which we were both born? Is there any more odious, any that makes the heart and spirit heave as much? How can intelligent men still give any credence to the obscure sayings and so-called miracles of the vile founder of this frightening creed? Has there ever existed a trickster more deserving of public indignation? How could a leprous Jew who was born of a whore and a soldier in the most wretched corner of the universe have dared to pass himself off as the instrument of him who, people say, created the world? You must admit, Thérèse, that to have such exalted pretensions you need some nobility at the very least. What can this ridiculous ambassador lay claim to? What did he do to prove his mission? Did the earth change its complexion? Did those scourges with which it was afflicted disappear? Did the sun shine upon it night and day? Did all vices cease to soil its surface? Were we henceforth to see only happiness reign? Not at all. It was by magic tricks, capers, and word plays that God's envoy introduced himself to the world. It was in the respectable company of workmen, artisans, and ladies of pleasure that heaven's minister arrived to display his greatness. It was by getting drunk with some and sleeping with others that God's friend, God himself, came to subject the hardened sinner to his laws. It was by inventing tricks based on whatever might satisfy either his desires or his greed that the rogue wished to demonstrate his mission. In spite of all this, he is a great success. A few related groups join the rascal, and a sect is formed. This rabble's dogmas manage to seduce a handful of Jews. Slaves of the Roman Empire, they must have joyfully embraced a religion which released them from their chains only to prepare them for the yoke of religion. Their motives are suspected, their intractability becomes clear, the rebels are arrested, and their leader perishes, but he dies, in a manner that is probably far too lenient for his type of crime, and as a result of an unforgivable lack of reflection, the vulgar fellow's disciples are allowed to disperse instead of being put to death with him. People are gripped by fanaticism. Women wail, madmen argue, imbeciles believe. And the most contemptible of men, the clumsiest of rascals, the greatest impostor who had ever lived, is God, the son of God, equal to his father. Suddenly all his delusions are sanctified, all his sayings become dogmas, and his stupid ideas mysteries. The bosom of his fabulous father opens to receive him, and this creator, who was alone hitherto, has now become a trinity to humour a son worthy of his greatness. But does this holy God stop there? Certainly not. His celestial powers will lend themselves to much greater favours. At the whim of a priest, that is, of a knave full of lies and crimes, this great God who created all we see will condescend to come down to earth millions of times a morning and enter a piece of pastry which has to be digested by the faithful and will soon be transformed in the depths of their bowels into the vilest excrement. And all for the satisfaction of his beloved son, the odious man who invented this monstrous impiety at an inn supper. As he himself said, let it be so. He said, this bread that you see will be my flesh, and you will eat it as such. Now I am God, so God will be eaten by you. Therefore, because I have said so, the creator of heaven and earth will be changed into the vilest matter than can be expelled by the human body, and man will eat God because this God is good and all-powerful. However, this nonsense spreads. This growth is attributed to its reality, its greatness, its sublimeness, to the power of him who introduced it. And the nonsense spreads for the simplest of reasons, whilst the prestige so falsely acquired is only ever won over rogues on the one hand and imbeciles on the other. This outrageous religion finally establishes itself on the throne, and it is a weak, cruel, ignorant, and fanatical emperor who wraps it in the diadem of royalty and in this way soils the whole world with it. Oh, Thérèse, what weight can these considerations carry with a critical and philosophical mind? Can the wise see anything in this dreadful collection of fables but the fruit of the imposture of some men and the false credulity of a greater number? If God had wanted us to have any kind of religion, and if he were truly all-powerful, or rather if there really were a God, would he have communicated his commands to us by such absurd means? Would it be through the medium of a despicable bandit that he would have shown us how to serve him? If this God that you speak of is supreme, if he is all-powerful, if he is just, if he is good, will it be by tricks and conundrums that he would wish to teach me how to know and serve him? sovereign engine of the universe and of the heart of man, can he not instruct us by means of the stars or convince us by engraving himself in man's heart? Let him one day imprint the law that would please him and that he would like to give us at the sun's centre and in tongues of fire. From one end of the universe to the other, all mankind would see it and read it, and would in consequence be guilty if they did not then follow it. But to declare his wishes only in some unknown corner of Asia, to choose the most double-dealing and the most superstitious of peoples as followers, and the vilest, most ridiculous, and most roguish working man as representative, to muddle up the message so much that it is impossible to comprehend, to teach it only to a tiny number of individuals while leaving everyone else in the dark, and to punish them for remaining there. Oh, no, Therese, no, no, such atrocities cannot be our guide. I would rather die 1,000 times than believe in them. When atheism wants martyrs, let it choose them, and my blood is ready. We should detest these horrors, Therese. The best documented outrages should serve to strengthen the contempt that they rightly deserve. I had scarcely opened my eyes when I detested these simple delusions. From that moment, I made it my rule to trample them underfoot and took an oath never to return to them. Do as I do, if you wish to be happy. Detest, renounce, curse, as I do, both the odious object of this frightful cult and the cult itself, created for fantasy and, like fantasy, made to be vilified by all those who claim to be wise.
Oh, monsieur, I replied in tears. You would deprive a wretched girl of her fondest hope if you cast a slur in her heart on that religion which consoles her. Firmly attached to what it teaches, absolutely convinced that all of the attacks it suffers are nothing but the effects of libertinism and passion, would I sacrifice the idea I hold most dear, that which is closest to my heart, to sophisms and blasphemies that fill me with horror?
I added 1,000 other arguments to these, but the Comte just laughed at them, and his specious principles, expressed with a more virile eloquence and supported by authors which I am glad to say I have never read, attacked those I had read every day but without shaking my faith in them. Madame de Pressac, who was filled with virtue and piety, was not unaware that her nephew justified his waywardness with reference to the latest paradoxes. She frequently complained about them to me, and as she was gracious enough to ascribe a little more common sense to me than to her other female servants, she liked to confide her concerns in me. Yet her nephew's bad behaviour towards her now knew no bounds, the Comte having reached the point of hiding nothing from her any longer. Not only had he surrounded his aunt with all of the dangerous scoundrels who served his pleasures, but he had even been bold enough to declare to her in my presence that if she was still minded to oppose his tastes, he would convince her of the charms they offered by indulging them before her very eyes. I groaned with horror at such behaviour. I tried to find personal reasons to stifle in my heart the unhappy flame of passion that burned there. But is love an illness that one can recover from? All of my attempts to quell it merely served to make its flame burn more brightly, and the perfidious Comte never appeared more lovable to me than when I had taken account of everything that should have made me detest him. I had now been in this house for 4 years, still tormented by the same worries, still consoled by the same sweet thoughts, when this abominable man, finally believing he could trust me, dared to reveal to me his infamous designs. At that time we were in the country, and I was alone with the Comtesse, her principal maidservant having got permission to remain in Paris for the summer to assist her husband with some business or other. One evening, shortly after I had retired, I was taking the air on the balcony of my bedchamber, not being able to sleep because of the extreme heat, and the Comte suddenly knocked on my door, begging me to allow him to talk with me. Alas, every moment granted me by this cruel author of my woes seemed too precious to me to refuse a single one. He entered, carefully closing the door behind him, and sat on a chair beside me.
"Listen to me, Therese," he said to me with a little hesitation. "I have something to tell you of the greatest consequence,
Swear to me that you will never reveal anything I am going to say.
Oh, monsieur,
I replied,
how can you think me capable of abusing your trust?
You do not know the risks you would be taking should you happen to prove to me that I was wrong to trust you.
To lose your trust would be the very worst of my fears, and I need no greater threat.
Well then, Thérèse, I have condemned my aunt to death, and your hand will be my instrument.
My hand? I cried, recoiling in horror. Oh, monsieur, how could you conceive such plans? Oh, no, take my life if you must, but do not ever imagine that you can persuade me to commit the horrific act you are proposing.
Listen, Thérèse, the comte said to me, calmly leading me back to his subject. I suspected you would react with repugnance, but as you are an intelligent girl, I flatter myself that I can overcome it, that I can prove to you that this crime, which seems so enormous to you, is in fact just a simple affair. Your untrained mind must confront two heinous crimes, Thérèse, the destruction of a creature who is like us, and the greater evil that this destruction represents when this creature is close to us. As far as the crime of destruction of one's fellow is concerned, rest assured, my dear girl, that this is purely illusory. The power of destruction is not in the gift of man. He may, at the most, change the form of things, but he does not have the power to annihilate. Now, all forms are equal in the eyes of nature. Nothing is lost in the immense crucible in which nature's changes are carried out. All the pieces of matter which end up there are continually reborn in other guises, and whatever our feelings towards them may be, nature is not outraged by any. Not a single one could offend against it. Whatever we destroy replenishes its powers, renews its energy, but no act of destruction weakens it. None works contrary to it. Oh, what does it matter to nature's eternal creation that the mass of flesh which today makes up a biped creature should tomorrow be reproduced as 1,000 different insects? Dare we say that the construction of this two-footed animal is more valuable to it than that of a tiny earthworm, and that nature must take a greater interest in it? If, therefore, the degree of attachment, or rather of indifference, is the same, what can it matter to her that the sword of one man can change another man into flies or blades of grass? When I have been convinced of the exalted status of our species, when it has been demonstrated to me that we are so important to nature that these transmutations necessarily offend against its laws, then I shall be able to believe that murder is a crime. But when the profoundest investigations have proved to me that everything that lives on this globe, including the most imperfect of nature's works, is of equal value in its eyes, I shall never admit that the transformation of one of these beings into 1,000 others can in any way be injurious to its plans. I say this. All men, all animals, all plants that grow, feed, and are destroyed, reproducing themselves by the same means, never truly die, but merely undergo variation and modification. All, I say, appearing today in one form and a few years later in another, may change 1,000 times in a single day at the whim of the creature that wishes to transform them without a single law of nature being broken at any time. I tell you that this happens without such changes doing anything but good, since, in decomposing individuals whose reconstitution once again becomes necessary to nature, they merely return to nature by an action incorrectly described as criminal. She is consequently deprived by this creative energy by those who, through stupid indifference, dare not undertake any transformations. Oh, Thérèse, it is only man's pride that made murder a crime. Imagining himself to be the most sublime being on the planet and the most essential to it, this vain creature proceeded from this false principle to ensure that any action that would destroy his fellows must necessarily be a foul one. But his vanity, his folly, in no way changes the laws of nature. There is no person that does not, at bottom, experience the most vehement desire to be rid of those who bother him, or whose death may bring him some profit. And do you imagine, Therese, that there is such a great difference between this desire and its consequence? Now, if these impressions come to us from nature, how can we assume that they offend it? Would she inspire in us actions that would do it harm? Ah, rest assured, my dear girl, there is nothing that we feel that does not serve her. All the promptings she sends us are the instruments of her laws. Human passions are nothing but the means which she employs to achieve her aims. When she needs more individuals, she inspires love in us and thus creates them. When destruction becomes necessary to her, she fills our hearts with vengeance, avarice, lewdness, and ambition, and so we have murders. But she has always worked in her own interests, and without suspecting it, we have become the credulous agents of her whims. Oh, no, Therese, no, nature does not place in our hands the means to disrupt her economy. Can it make any sense to say that the weakest can really offend against the strongest? What are we relative to her? Can she, when creating us, have placed in us anything capable of harming her? Can this stupid supposition be reconciled with the certain and sublime ways in which we see her achieve her goals? Oh, if murder were not one of man's actions that best fulfilled her intentions, would she allow it to take place? Therefore, how can it harm her to imitate her? Can she be offended to see man do to his neighbour what she herself does to him every day? Since it is demonstrable that she can reproduce only by destroying, if we destroy incessantly, are we not acting in conformity with her wishes? In this sense, therefore, the man who devotes himself to it with the greatest enthusiasm will incontestably be the one who serves her best, since he will be the one who cooperates most with intentions constantly manifested by her. The first principle and the finest quality of nature is the movement that constantly drives her, but this movement is nothing but a perpetual succession of crimes. It is by crimes alone that this is preserved. The being that is most like nature, and that is consequently the most perfect of beings, will therefore necessarily be the one whose most active movement becomes the cause of many crimes, whilst, I repeat, the inactive or indolent being, that is to say the virtuous being, must certainly be the least perfect in her eyes, since it has only apathetic or peaceful tendencies which would constantly keep everything in chaos if it were to be dominant. A balance must be preserved, and this can be done only by dint of crimes. Thus crimes serve nature. If they serve her, if she requires them, if she wants them, can they offend her? And who can be offended by them if she is not? But the creature I am destroying is my aunt. Oh, Therese, how frivolous these ties are in the eyes of a philosopher. Permit me not even to talk about them, such as their futility. Can these despicable chains, the fruit of our laws and political institutions, have any significance in the eyes of nature? Leave aside your prejudices, then, Therese. Serve me, and your fortune is made.
Oh, monsieur, I replied to the Comte de Bressac, full of fear. This indifference which you assume to be present in nature is yet again nothing but the product of your intellectual sophistry. Deign rather to listen to your heart, and you will hear it condemn these false arguments inspired by libertinism. Return to your heart as judge, and you will find it to be the sanctuary where the nature that you outrage wishes to be listened to and respected. If that is where nature expresses the profoundest horror of the crime which you are contemplating, will you grant me that it is to be condemned? I know that you are presently blinded by your passions, but once these are extinguished, you will be eaten away by remorse. The greater your sensitivity, the more you will be tormented by its pricks. Oh, monsieur, preserve and respect the life of this gentle and precious friend. Do not sacrifice her, or you will die of despair. Every day, every instant, you would see before your eyes that dear aunt that your blind fury would have plunged into the tomb. You would hear her plaintive voice once again pronounce those sweet words that were the joy of your childhood. She would appear in all your waking moments and would torment you in your dreams. With her bloody fingers, she would reopen those wounds that you would have torn into her flesh. From that time on, you would not enjoy a single happy moment on this earth. All of your pleasures would be sullied, all of your thoughts would be troubled. A celestial hand, whose power you do not know, would avenge the life you would have destroyed by poisoning your own. And you would die from the mortal regret of daring to carry out your crimes before you could enjoy their rewards.
I was in tears as I said these words on my knees at the Comte's feet. I begged him, by all that he found most sacred, to forget an infamous aberration that I swore to him I would keep secret all my life. But I did not know the man I was dealing with. I did not know the extent to which passions engendered crime in this perverse soul. The Comte rose icily to his feet.
"I see clearly that I was mistaken, Thérèse,"
he said to me.
"I am perhaps as dismayed for your sake as for mine. No matter. I shall find other means, and you will have lost a great deal without your mistress having gained anything."
This threat changed all of my thinking. By not agreeing to carry out the crime proposed to me, I risked much on my own account, and my mistress would certainly die. By agreeing to be his accomplice, I would protect myself from the Comte's wrath, and I could definitely save his aunt. This reflection, which was the work of an instant in me, made up my mind to accept everything. But as such a sudden change of heart might have appeared suspect, I made my acquiescence seem harder to win over, forcing the Comte to keep repeating his sophisms to me. Gradually, I began to look as if I had no answers to them, and Pressac believed he had defeated me. I made it seem as if my weakness were ascribable to the power of his rhetoric, and finally gave in. The Comte threw himself into my arms. How this gesture would have filled me with joy if it had had another cause. What am I saying? Such times were long gone. His horrible behaviour, his barbaric schemes, had stifled all the feelings that my weak heart had dared to entertain, and now he was nothing but a monster in my eyes.
"You are the first woman I have embraced," the Comte said to me, "and truly I do so with all my heart. You are delicious, my child. A ray of wisdom has penetrated your mind. Is it possible that such a charming intellect should have remained in the dark for so long?"
We then agreed on what we would do. In a couple of days' time, more or less, depending on how easy I would find it, I was to empty a small packet of poison given to me by Pressac into the cup of chocolate that Madame was accustomed to take in the morning. The Comte would ensure that I was immune from any prosecution. He would issue me with a contract for 2,000 écus annual income on the very day of the execution. He made me these promises without explaining in what ways I would benefit from them, and we separated. Meanwhile, something so very singular occurred, something so revealing of the atrocious thought processes of the monster I was dealing with, that I must interrupt for a moment the account that you are doubtless awaiting of the outcome of the adventure in which I had become involved. 2 days after our criminal pact, the Comte learnt that an uncle whose legacy he did not expect to receive had just left him an annual income of 80,000 livres. "Oh, heaven," I said to myself when I heard this news. "Is this how divine justice punishes those who plot crimes?" Then, soon recovering from this blasphemous reaction to divine providence, I knelt down and begged God's forgiveness, flattering myself that this unexpected event would at least change the Comte's plans. How wrong I was.
"Oh, my dear Thérèse," he said to me, having come up to my room the very same evening, "see how I am being showered with good fortune. As I have often told you, the idea of a crime or its execution is the surest means of attracting luck. Only wicked men do so."
"What's that, monsieur?" I replied.
So this fortune, which you were not expecting, has not persuaded you to wait patiently for the death that you wish to hasten?
Wait? The Comte abruptly replied. I won't wait a single moment, Therese. Let me tell you that I am 28 years old and that it is hard to wait at my age. No, please realize that this in no way changes our plans and assure me that the whole business will be completed before we are due to return to Paris. Tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow at the very latest. I am already anxious to pay you the first quarter of your annuity, to place into your hands a document that secures it for you.
I did my best to disguise the fear that this excess of eagerness inspired in me, and I resumed my earlier resolve, quite persuaded that if I did not commit the horrible crime to which I had agreed, the Comte would soon notice that I was toying with him, and that if I warned Madame de Bressac, whatever measures the revelation of this plan made her adopt, the young Comte would still see that he had been betrayed, and would immediately take more certain steps that would bring about the aunt's death just the same while exposing me to all of the nephew's revenge. The path of justice was the only option left, but nothing in the world could have made me resolve to take it. I determined, therefore, to warn the Marquise. Of all possible alternatives, this one seemed the best one to me, and I chose it. Madame, I said to her the day following my last meeting with the Comte, I have something of the greatest importance to disclose to you, but no matter how closely it concerns you, I am determined not to say anything unless you first give me your word of honour not to bear any grudge against Monsieur your nephew for what he has the audacity to be planning. You will, of course, act, Madame, taking all necessary steps, but you will not say a word. Please promise me this, or else I shall keep silent. Madame de Bressac, who believed that it was just a matter of her nephew's usual outrages, took the oath that I had demanded of her, and I revealed all. The unfortunate woman burst into tears on learning of this infamy.
The monster!
She cried.
Have I ever done anything that was not in his interests? If I wish to warn against his vices or cure him of them, what other motive but his happiness could make me be so harsh? And is it not thanks to me that he has inherited this legacy? Oh, Therese, Therese, give me solid proof that this plan is true. Put me in a position whereby I cannot have the slightest doubt. I need anything that can help extinguish in me all those feelings that my deluded heart still dares harbour for that monster.
So then I showed her the packet of poison. It would have been hard to produce better proof. The Marquise wanted to try it out, so we gave a small dose to a dog, which we shut away and which died 2 hours later in horrible convulsions. Madame de Bressac could have no more doubts, and she determined to act. She instructed me to give her the rest of the poison, and immediately wrote a letter to the Duc de Sansevieres, a relative of hers, bidding him to pay a secret visit to the minister in order to report the crime plotted by her nephew, and of which she was about to become the victim, to obtain a lettre de cachet, and to come with all possible speed to her home to deliver her from the villain who was conspiring so cruelly against her life. However, this abominable crime was destined to take place. By a divine will that defies comprehension, virtue was bound to yield to the machinations of the wicked. The animal on which we had conducted our experiment revealed all to the Comte, who heard it howling. Knowing that this dog was dear to his aunt, he asked what had happened to it. Those he spoke to, not knowing anything, gave no clear response. From that moment he began to harbour suspicions. He did not say a word, but I could see that he was troubled. I told the Marquise about his mood. She became more concerned, though all she could think of doing was to send the letter with all possible haste and to do all she could to keep its purpose secret. She told her nephew that she was sending someone by coach to Paris to ask the Duc de Sansevieres to take charge immediately of the legacy which he had just inherited from his uncle, because if no one appeared, she feared there might be lawsuits. She added that she was bidding the Duke to come and give her all the necessary information so that she might decide to accompany her nephew, if the business required it. The Comte,
who was too good at reading expressions not to see confusion on his aunt's face and not to observe some embarrassment on my own, divined everything and put himself even more on his guard. On the pretext of taking a walk, he left the castle grounds and waited for the messenger at a spot where he was bound to pass by. Being more loyal to him than to his aunt, this man was perfectly willing to hand him his dispatches, and, convinced of what he doubtless called my treachery, Pressac gave the messenger 100 livres.